I didn't realize I was wasting $415 a month until I downloaded Rocket Money. I thought I had my finances under control until the app laid out all my spending and categorized it for me. Takeout, shopping, and unused subscriptions were quietly draining my account. And as a result, my savings took a backseat. But Rocket Money doesn't just tell you what you're wasting money on. It takes action to save you money. First, the app looks at your income and monthly expenses and calculates how much you can safely spend each day to stay under budget. Rocket Money also finds and cancels unwanted subscriptions for you and even negotiates better rates on your bills, so you have more money in your pocket. On average, Rocket Money members can save up to $740 a year when using all the app's premium features. Users love the app with over 186,000 five-star ratings. It's time to simplify your finances and take control of your money. Go to rocketmoney.com/cancel to get started. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel. rocketmoney.com/cancel.
Michelle Doherty Thomas should have had a lifetime to come into herself. Instead, the 17-year-old mother was pressured into becoming a narcotics informant to help police bust a drug ring. That one decision likely got her killed. This is her story.
Hi, I'm Vanessa.
And I'm Amy.
And you're listening to She Goes by Jane.
At the end of this episode and every episode, we will be joined by a special guest who will read an original poem by Amy Baker about the women we're featuring. This week, we are joined by Christine Solomon.
Hi, Vanessa.
Hi, Amy.
Vanessa, something that we haven't mentioned in a while is that we have a Patreon account.
That's right, we do.
That's where you're going to find like extra content, like our behind the poems, where we go behind the poems.
Yeah. And then we turn the tables a little bit and I get to ask Amy all kinds of questions.
Yes. And then I have the answer. But you get to find out the inspiration for the poems and kind of some of the deeper meanings that we don't talk about during the episode.
Yeah. Sometimes we have other like fun little details, or we get off on like a side route.
Yes.
Yes.
Yes. And we also have our book clubs. We talk about a book selection each month. So that's where you can find that content. Also, I have a newsletter called Girl Hunt. So if you want extra content in the form of reading instead of listening, you can check out that for, I don't know, I talk about all kinds of true crime stuff, but women-centered true crime
stuff.
So we're just everywhere these days.
Yes, go check it out.
Now we have to get merch.
We should.
Yeah, someone sent me a blanket and was like, you need to get blankets.
Blankets?
For like, you know, true crime.
Like cozy time?
Cozy time. True crime.
Cozy. Yeah, I don't know. I mean, it shouldn't go hand in hand, but it does. Maybe some like a coffee mug and a little blankie.
There you go. Yeah.
Or we could just go the regular route and get like t-shirts and toques.
Toques. Toques.
Mm-hmm. What's wrong with toques? You're so Canadian. What do you call them? A beanie?
I mean, it's like a hat. It's a hat.
A woolen cap?
A woolen cap, yes. So we will figure that out at some point. But for now, we have the Patreon account. We also have, I have Girl Hunt. So now I've been avoiding this because, Vanessa, how angry are you prepared to be today?
That sounds like a really loaded question. Like, am I going to be, like, I wasn't prepared to be angry at all today, but apparently I will be.
Yes. So this episode is about a young woman named Michelle Doherty Thomas, and we're going to touch on a few topics that I know make you particularly upset.
Oh, no.
Yes.
The ones that actually make me in particular upset?
Yeah.
I mean, we talking about the dreaded runaway situation?
No.
Okay.
No.
Does it have to do with teenagers? I get like
it does.
Super this is protective of teenagers.
Right.
So runaway like, or not.
To be clear, Vanessa does find like basically every episode that we talk about emotionally devastating, but particularly ones with teenagers. Michelle is a teenager.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a case where it's a teenager whose case isn't taken as seriously as it should have been.
They never are. That's the thing that really, so like on top of them being little babies that need to be protected, people don't take it seriously. We think of teenagers as like these wild things that are not in need of protecting.
Right. And this is a teenager whose story didn't get the kind of media attention it should have.
Okay. Yeah. Mm-hmm. I don't understand this. Like, college student, all the media stuff. High schooler, nothing.
Yeah. So, right? So Michelle is in high school.
Okay.
She's young. She's been getting in kind of some trouble.
So I'm already a little angry.
Yeah.
And we haven't even started talking.
Right. And particularly once we get into the part with how she's used by the police. Yeah. So, I mean, even I was talking this over with my husband, like I do every episode before it makes it here. And he was like livid. So, okay. So, but before we get into Michelle's story, we kind of have to establish a few things first. So okay. For those of you who are joining us, like, for the first time, this episode falls into our series on the Texas killing fields.
More,
yes.
Okay.
So you don't have to listen to them in order or listen to all of them to understand this episode. But hearing all of them, I think, gives you a much broader picture and perspective, and I think helps clarify what is happening in this area at this time. Now, the Texas killing fields refers broadly to an area of Texas between Houston and Galveston along Highway 45 corridor, where there have been a series of missing and murdered women. Last time, Vanessa asked me how many women are included in this count, and it's hard to say specifically, but generally we're talking about over 35 cases since the 1970s.
Like, I don't, is this just actually, like, the murderiest little bit of America?
You know, actually, I am really fascinated by, like, places that have, like, high rates of crime like this. Mm-hmm. Or, like, you know, kind of like those dark spots. And I don't know, honestly.
Because, so, like, there's not a ton of people in this particular area.
Yeah, I mean, I think
there's a ton of murder.
There is. So one of the things that we've talked about previously is what the police have said is like, oh, well, the problem is there's a lot of people in and out of this area because you've got Houston, you've got Galveston, and like people are flowing between, people are in and out. But honestly, from what we can tell, a lot of the crime has been crimed by people who live in the area. So,
mm-hmm.
Yeah, so take that for what it's worth. But because our podcast focuses on missing and unidentified women, we're not covering all 35 of those individually. We are talking about just the ones who are missing or unidentified. Okay.
Which is still a lot.
Which is still a lot. So we have episode 22, which was about Audrey Lee Cook and Donna Prudhomme, who were unidentified for nearly 30 years. Episode 26 about Shelley Sykes, who went missing in 1986. She's going to be mentioned a bit in this episode. Episode 31 about Todd Tran-Harriman, who went missing in 2001. And one of our more recent episodes, episode 59, about Suzanne Renee Richardson, who went missing in 1987, and she'll be mentioned in here as well. Now, if we put all of this in chronological order, though, Michelle, who we're talking about today, she goes missing before all of those women when she was last seen October 5th, 1985. Audrey Lee Cook, who had been one of those unidentified women, she would be the next who went missing since she was last seen in December of that year. So kind of situating us in where we are in time and place. So, Michelle was born on November 16th, 1967, to Pat and Phyllis Doherty. And they lived in this area outside of Galveston called Alta Loma. It's now part of Santa Fe, Texas. This is my realization that there's a Santa Fe, Texas.
Yeah.
Which, by the way, we contacted the police there. We did not get Michelle's files.
They said no?
They said no. Now, Michelle is the oldest daughter, and it sounds like she was doing okay during her childhood. Her mom said Michelle was this petite itty-bitty thing, in her words, not mine, and that she had 10,000 freckles.
Aww.
Yeah. And those stay with her. She's got this, like, beautiful freckles. She says Michelle was a personable child and that she never met a stranger, and she was very outgoing and was a little spitfire. She also said Michelle wasn't afraid of anything either. But like a lot of the young women that we talk about, the transition into high school was a turning point for her. So this is just like a really hard time in a lot of people's lives.
It is. And I think that's where people get so off track with teenagers and the care they should be putting into cases like this. Because they're like, oh, she was probably going down the wrong road. Or I don't know what is coming, but like I'm guessing that it's going to be like that.
Right.
That kind of like mentality of like trouble happens to those who go looking for it, you know? And that makes me cringe. I cannot stand that mentality.
So that's definitely where we're going to
is it okay
end up, right? Like, okay, so this at this point in her life, she starts to get bored with school. She's restless, and I really want to call attention to this is the 1980s, so we're in a different mindset. Like, this is like my early childhood, right? Mm-hmm. Okay, so her mom Phyllis suspected that she could be using some drugs occasionally. And drugs feature prominently in the story because there was a drug crisis in the Santa Fe area, according to Phyllis. And that's actually still true today. There's an incredible amount of drug trafficking through Galveston County, even, you know, 40 years later. But Phyllis said that when Michelle got home from school, she would often tell her parents about guys who would just, like, come up on motorcycles during lunch breaks and sell drugs to students who were outside. Now, during high school, Michelle was dating a man 4 years older than her, and she told her parents that she wanted to get married.
So how old is Michelle at this point?
So she's about 15 and then turning 16, so he's 19, then 20.
Okay.
Yeah.
A little bit of a gap for those ages.
Yeah, so that's a significant...
Yes.
You're in very different places.
Right. Normally 4 years, like as an adult, 4 years is nothing. At this time in your life, 4 years is... quite a bit.
Yeah. I mean, like, I think we've discussed before on one of our Patreon things that, like, when I was 17, I was dating, like, a 23-year-old. Like, that's not... I
inappropriate.
Not have been happening.
No, that right? should not have happened. But, I mean, in the times, in your defense, that was, like, a normal thing for us. I have nothing to defend him about.
Yeah. No. Yeah.
Yeah.
Now, okay, so her father makes this decision. He does decide to sign for her to get married. So she wants to get married and he signs for her. At the time in Texas, you could get married under the age of 18 with parental consent. And that did include children under the age of 16. Now, that's changed in the past few years, though. And now there are no marriages under the age of 16. And from 16 to 18, you need a judge's consent. So
she's a smidge under 16 and she wants to marry this guy.
Yes.
So her dad is... her dad is saying yes.
So her dad's on board with it, right? Okay. Like, in part, that's because they do want to make Michelle happy, right?
Right.
Yeah.
What do you do, right?
What do you do, right?
Yeah, you move.
Like, we're running away. Yeah. Now, they also reasoned, like, because Michelle's, you know, in this space, she's getting kind of in some trouble, like, some stuff might be going on. So they decided that if she was married, they'd know where she was and what she was doing. Like, this is their rationale for it, right?
Right. I think that was a really normal thing to hear from parents, especially in, like, 70s, 80s, 90s.
Yeah.
Was like, oh, if they just settle down.
Settled down, yes.
Yeah.
Now, so a month after her 16th birthday, she's married. She also desperately wanted to have a baby. Mm-hmm. And not long after her wedding, she was pregnant. Now, her husband, you know, he's 20, which he's an adult, but like barely adult.
He's young. He's young. Yeah.
Yeah. So he couldn't support a pregnant wife or a wife and a son on, you know, his own. So the couple lived almost the entirety of the year and a half of marriage with Michelle's parents or next door at Michelle's grandparents' house.
Okay. So, Amy, a lot of the time you don't use names when somebody... are we not using his name?
Oh, good question. So it's that his name has not really been made public. And it's also more of like a respect for his privacy kind of thing.
Okay. So he's not okay in our book?
He should not have been marrying a 16-year-old. But aside from that.
Okay.
Yeah.
So I mean, we are not omitting him because he is the one at fault.
No.
Of the disappearance. Okay. Perfect.
No.
Okay.
Things are pretty rough for them as a couple. Like, they'd had their son in what I think is October 1984. Her mother said that Michelle had fallen in with the wrong crowd, and the two of them had some trouble with law enforcement. At one point, her husband's jailed, and then Michelle was implicated in a burglary and was potentially facing charges. Okay, so this is the part that really enrages me. That's when Michelle was enlisted by the Santa Fe Police Department to take part in a narcotics investigation. To my understanding from the reporting, her burglary charge was used as leverage. And so Michelle does take part in this narcotics investigation. They send her in wearing a wire.
Okay.
Now, the outcome of this drug bust is actually hard to find in the local papers. We know that it happened in March of 1985. And if it's the one that I found during my research, basically six people were arrested in March 1985 on County Road 422 in Brazoria County. 10 pounds of marijuana were seized, along with some hashish, a small amount of cocaine, a small amount of Mandrax, and LSD, along with two sawed-off shotguns and a stolen color television, which I love that they had to emphasize that it was color since this is 1985. Now, six people are arrested, like I said, and they're all like 18 and under.
Okay. Is this going to directly relate, you think, to her disappearance?
Yes.
So the police use her for this and then don't protect her later.
Right. So because not long after this, like, Michelle's marriage starts to fall apart, right? So her mother would later say she made mistakes. There's no doubt about it. All the bad things that they said she did them. And it was a secret. We know it. We aren't proud of it. And as it turned out, neither was she. But she was trying to do what she thought she had to keep her family together. And she was working on what she thought was a good marriage and family, and it wasn't. And she realized that she got out of it. Now, despite all that she's risking for this narcotics investigation, it looks like the burglary charges were not dropped.
Seriously?
Yeah.
So they did all of this. They made the arrests. She followed through and they didn't keep up what they promised?
Yeah.
Now, okay.
Okay. So several months after the drug bust, rumors start to swirl that Michelle's life was in danger because everyone seemed to know that she was the one who helped police. Now, Michelle felt like there was a lot of truth to these rumors, and her lawyer even warned her to get out of town as soon as her burglary case was finished.
It's a little predictable.
Yeah.
That's what could happen. I'm having trouble thinking that the police didn't see that.
Yeah. So, like, they basically used a teenager. They pressured a teenage mom
to do their dirty work.
Yeah.
And did not protect her afterwards and didn't even drop her charges.
Nope.
Okay.
Yeah. So, this is the part where I'm going to start mentioning dates, which.
Yeah. We know what that means.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. No.
October 5th, 1985. Michelle returns home from her job at their family-run service station in Galveston. Her plan was to go out for the evening and meet some friends at Cave Club in Galveston, which, by the way, is now demolished, but it was on Stewart Beach in Galveston. That night, she put on her Harley-Davidson tank top, threw on some jeans, and grabbed her purse and coat before heading out the door of her parents' house to get in a car with her friends, C and W. She knew both men and didn't think of leaving with them. Now, Michelle's friends waited for her at the club, but she never arrived.
Mm.
The next day, Michelle's family was set to celebrate Michelle's son's first birthday, but Michelle never came home.
Okay.
Her mother, Phyllis, said that when Michelle didn't come home that night, she knew immediately that something was wrong. Basically, because Michelle was living at home and working for family, they always knew where she was and that she would leave a note or call if she wasn't coming home.
So, C and W,
mm-hmm.
Do we know, are they part of the drug bust or are they friends with somebody that was in the drug bust? Like,
yeah, so it's really unclear. Like, I searched and searched the papers looking for more information about this drug bust. And so I have suspicions about what happened post this drug bust, but it really wasn't publicized much. Now, because most of the people were minors, or all of the people were minors when the drug bust happened, their names were not listed, just their, like, gender and ages. But Santa Fe is a pretty small town, so basically it leads me to believe that, like, I don't think C and W were part of the drug bust, but people know each other in small towns.
There's, like, connections to everyone, yeah. maybe.
Now, yeah, and I realize, like, that's incomplete reporting, but I really feel like what might have been done is, like, this small drug bust of a bunch of teenagers is used to, like, do a bigger drug bust later. But I have no evidence to...
So she led to this arrest, and then this arrest might lead to more of the police trying to get... Yeah, so, like, the bigger drug dealers and stuff like that?
That would be my suspicion. Okay. But I can't confirm that because it really was not publicized. This drug bust is, like, a blip of part of a different article. It took so long to find any information about this.
We'll be back in a moment.
Now... But we do know C and W are the men that she leaves with. When Michelle's disappearance was reported, a sheriff's department deputy tried to convince Michelle's family that she might have left willingly. Mm. There is notes of maybe she was a runaway here. And, like, I want to pause here again because, like, I am so angry for Michelle. Like, so again, like, we have a teenage mom who's used by the sheriff's department in something that, like, clearly would put her at risk. Mm-hmm. There's widespread rumors that her life is in jeopardy because of it. And when she doesn't come home, you just, like, what? You shrug your shoulders and say maybe she's a runaway?
Yeah, this is the kind of thing that makes me really angry. Obviously, she's not. First off, she seems extremely loved by her parents.
Yes.
And she has a baby.
And she has a baby. Who's about to turn one.
Yeah, there were reasons for her to go home.
Exactly. Now the police lack of action on this is perhaps why it takes until November until C and W are questioned about Michelle's disappearance. They said they were on their way to Cave Club that night and stopped at a convenience store where Michelle got out of the car and got into the back of another vehicle with two men inside.
Okay, so this is what C and W are saying, though. There are no eyewitnesses to this.
No, so this is just what they're saying.
Okay.
In December, though, a grand jury does indict C and W on charges of aggravated kidnapping, and this is when the two men start to change their story. They say that they were in W's car together when they stopped at an intersection on FM 517 west of the town of Dickinson. They said that while they were stopped, Michelle was forcibly taken from the car and forced into a different vehicle.
Okay, so that makes it less of a kidnapping on their part because... Now, she was kidnapped from them.
Right.
Nice.
So they're trying to spin this different story. They also claimed that when this happened, her purse and jacket were left behind in W's car, and that a few days later, they just decided to get rid of them. A few days after that, W gave the sheriff's department directions to a canal near Santa Fe where they might be able to find Michelle's belongings. There, a diver for the sheriff's department found Michelle's purse. Had been loaded down with rocks and gravel to help it sink. When they looked for her jacket, though, they were unable to find it. So, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, it looks a little...
Like, what? So if someone was forcibly kidnapped from your car, your friend was taken from your car, and she left behind her belongings, like, you never contacted anyone?
Didn't report it. You didn't give her belongings back to her family. You didn't give them to the police.
And then
you didn't just keep, like, them in case she resurfaces. No, you're weighing them down with rocks.
Exactly. Now, the next bit of information doesn't come out until January. The police get a warrant to search another man's car. We're going to call him T. The information that's released publicly is that W and C say he's the driver of the car that Michelle was supposedly forced into. The Texas Department of Public Safety crime lab experts arrive from Houston where they spend the entire day going over the car. There they find four hairs, but they couldn't prove if they were Michelle's. They did say, though, the car was so clean that it was clear that someone had gone through it and extensively cleaned the vehicle. Now, in February, T is indicted for capital murder charges. It's likely here that, for the first time, the public learns that Michelle is presumed to be dead. During this, a fourth unnamed man sat before a grand jury, but was never indicted, nor... as far as I know, has his name been made public. So here it seems like the case is progressing, but not necessarily is everything making it into the papers. That's not unusual, particularly as a case is building. But just as quickly as it seems like it's starting to come together, everything fell apart. The charges against all three men are dropped, although to be clear, in T's case, it's specifically mentioned it's without prejudice, which means the same charges could be brought in the future.
So is it on pause, or are they actually, like, changing things?
Yeah, so basically what's being said at this point is, like, we don't have enough information.
Yeah.
So we're going to drop the charges.
What is happening?
Right, because, like, if you've gotten this far, you're wondering this. What the heck is happening?
Right.
Like, and you're not alone. So I wanted us to feel at least a little bit of, in this podcast, that feeling of incompleteness and not knowing the whole story. Because in general, the public and the Doherty family are not receiving information about this case. Phyllis would later say that she wasn't being kept in the loop about what was happening, and the papers weren't covering it either. In fact, when Michelle disappeared in October, Phyllis says that she pushed and pushed to get her disappearance in the paper, but it wasn't until November that a piece ran, and it was on a back page. You can actually see this today. It's like a little blurb about her. From there, there's only a handful of articles at the time, one about C&W being arrested, one about the indictment about against T, and then there's just, like, silence.
But you are going to continue the story, right?
Yes. Yeah,
so you're not just going to leave it? It's not just like, goodbye, guys.
We're done.
We're done.
No.
Okay.
Okay. So a few months after Michelle goes missing, Shelley Sykes goes missing after finishing work at a restaurant on Galveston Island, and she's headed to her boyfriend's house when she's forced off the road by two men who kidnap and kill her.
Mm-hmm.
The year after that, almost 2 years exactly to the day, college student Suzanne Richardson is working at her job as an overnight clerk at a condo/hotel complex when she disappears a little after 6 a.m. Now, for Shelley and Suzanne, the media attention is immediate. The news coverage about their disappearance spreads nationally, and flyers and billboards are springing up in the search for both women. Phyllis felt like this wasn't happening for her child. She said she didn't understand why the charges were dropped, meaning that it was never made clear to her by law enforcement or lawyers. She also didn't get or know how to get publicity or how to go about setting up a reward fund. Like, she just didn't know what to do.
So, like, I have a couple of questions with that. Yeah. One, I forget how old Shelley and Suzanne were. Were they older than 16?
Yeah, so they're both, so, you know, Shelley, I read someplace it was like referring to her as a college student. She wasn't. She was actually on pause from college, but she's, what, 19 at the time? Okay. And Suzanne is in her early 20s.
Because this ignored ages that we're seeing are usually from like 13 to 18.
Right. Like, where's
the... And then once you're beyond that. And then the other thing is, are the police kind of skirting around her case because they know that they probably were the cause of it?
Yeah, well... We're going to get into that a little bit, but no, they don't take any ownership of anything here. No, no,
no.
Yeah. So, you know, for Phyllis, her mom, like, seeing all this happen, she ends up saying, like, don't get me wrong. I wish that they would find the Sykes child and the Richardson child. I wish they would find all missing children alive and well. Unfortunately, in our case, that can't happen, but I don't see why my child can't be shown the same respect as the others.
That's really just, like, the most heartbreaking statement.
Yeah. You know, her mom, like, a lot of the coverage from her mom is talking about, like, why is my daughter not getting enough coverage, but then the media never takes a step to actually give her the coverage. Like, the coverage isn't the story about how she's not covered. The story is, like, what happened to her. What happened to Michelle.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Now, when law enforcement is asked about these discrepancies, they have stock answers. So Shelley and Michelle's case are both handled by the same sheriff's department. The chief deputy, Gene Leonard, says, Shelley Sykes represented everyone's daughter. She had been going to college. She had a job. She had gone to work. She had gone through a normal day, and she was headed home for a normal evening after work, and it was the kind of case that you'd expect to happen in New York City or Los Angeles or in Houston. You don't expect that to happen in Galveston, Texas. And the uniqueness of it touched the hearts and minds of every citizen.
The uniqueness of a normal girl going missing on a normal day?
Right. Yeah.
That's if there's anything we're learning, or that I'm learning, is that any girl can go missing on any day in any place.
Yeah.
And it has nothing to do with the girl.
Yeah. So, like, what Leonard is doing here is, like, he's trying to create, like, even this article in which, like, specifically Phyllis is trying to call attention to her daughter's story, is, like, he creates a dichotomy between Shelley and Michelle. Like, if Shelley represents everyone's daughter, what does Michelle represent?
Right.
If Shelley's story is not one that you expect to happen in Galveston, Texas, then what is Michelle's, right?
But also what makes one more valuable than the other?
Exactly. Like, Michelle went missing the year before Shelley. Michelle's case and story should have been the one that shocked people about what kinds of crimes could happen in Galveston.
Everything he said, whether it was to, in his opinion, like, a good thing to say or not, it's really hurtful.
Yeah, because he's essentially saying, oh, well, this is why we care so much about Shelley and not
like your daughter's Michelle. Riffraff. We don't care about her. Shelley is everybody's daughter, so we care about her.
Yeah, because, like, Michelle is also everyone's daughter.
Right. She is very loved, and she is this young mom. Like,
yeah.
Yeah, we, okay.
Phyllis said, like, essentially that Michelle is depicted as a bad kid. Yeah. And that the way she was painted in the media pieces, who, like, those are how she was covered. Like, Phyllis said, it made it look like my child, they had cleaned up a little scum off the street and it was no great loss. They'll shove it under the carpet and that's it. And that's how I feel this has been handled.
Her poor mother.
Mm-hmm. Now, like, I just think it's interesting because, like, countless families also have kids who are struggling through their teenage year. Like, Michelle isn't an aberration. Like,
no.
But the way she was used as an informant was, right?
But also, we can find the so-called troubled kids with as much enthusiasm as we can try to find the so-called normal kids.
Right. Yeah. Now, Wayne Kessler, a sheriff's department investigator assigned to the case, said that his understanding of why Shelley's case had gained more traction is that Shelley was a victim of random, spontaneous violence, whereas Michelle seemed to be premeditated. Mm-hmm. And he said that suddenly the realization struck that it could happen to anyone. If it could happen to Shelley Sykes, it could happen to anyone.
Because it can.
And it's like, okay, well, like, tons of families and tons of kids look like Michelle, right? Like, the messaging here should also be, if it can happen to Michelle, it can happen to anyone.
Yeah. Well, we know it can happen to anyone.
Yeah.
And it does.
Mm-hmm. Now, when Shelley Sykes disappeared, her family was also told by Wayne Kessler not to publicize the case. So I think the concern here was always framed as, if Shelley was alive, such publicity could cause someone to harm her.
Hmm.
This is not an edict that they followed. They basically plastered Galveston County and everywhere they could reach with information about their missing daughter. We know that it's their efforts that brought a missing person poster to a bar in Mexico where one of her kidnappers and killers saw the poster. This was ultimately instrumental in getting him to confess what happened to Shelley that night. Phyllis had also been told not to publicize Michelle's case. Unlike Shelley's family, though, she followed this advice. Phyllis said, you go to a doctor, he gives you a pill, you take the pill because he's a doctor. You go to the police and they tell you to keep your mouth shut, and you keep your mouth shut because you think you're doing the right thing.
Right. And as we saw with Shelley, she wasn't alive, but it still answered some questions.
Yes.
It's not like, for any of these girls, I don't think we're putting them in more danger by trying to find them.
Yeah. So this was like what they were told. Like, they were given the same advice.
Yeah.
Now, eventually, Phyllis realized that these directions are not bringing her any closer to bringing her daughter home.
Mm-hmm.
Now, everything we know about the case comes from Phyllis' efforts to get justice for her daughter and to find her. Shelley's stepmother, Denise, also helped publicize Suzanne Richardson's disappearance. She helps Phyllis as well. What we now know is that in November 1985, a month after Michelle went missing, two separate anonymous informants told the sheriff's department about a large field west of Pearson Road in Alta Loma, Texas. It's to this bean field that Michelle was supposedly taken. It's also here that she was apparently murdered and buried. One of the informants confirmed that Michelle had been killed because she'd worn a wire and served as an informant. Now, 2 days after this call, investigators searched the field on foot and also did an aerial search using Houston Police Department helicopters. When this failed to locate Michelle, they brought in DPS dogs and did another 2-day search on foot and horseback. Investigators said that they feel comfortable with this search and felt that they would have found it.
What's it?
Her body.
Yeah.
Yeah. They didn't even say we found Michelle.
Oh my God.
Or we would have found Michelle. They called her it because they spent days and days out there. And I'd like to bring up that, you know, in our episode on Suzanne Richardson, they also believe that she might be buried in a field, and they have gone to that field over and over and over looking for her, but not Michelle. Now, in the end, the cases against all three men were dropped because there was no physical or scientific evidence tying them to Michelle's murder beyond finding Michelle's purse in the canal. They only have one shot to convict these men, and they just didn't feel like the case had come together enough to make it happen. Now, investigators do feel, though, that a lot of people are holding information about Michelle's disappearance and, you know, believed murder, but they just haven't come forward yet. Now, in the years since all the women of the Texas killing fields, they've gotten less and less coverage, right? Mm-hmm. But Michelle has almost entirely disappeared from the newspapers. In 1990 and 1991, papers covered both Michelle and Suzanne, since the anniversaries of their disappearances are only days apart. In it, Phyllis talks about how she and Michelle's dad are raising Michelle's son. She said, "She was just a child herself when we lost her. I don't know what I'm supposed to tell her child. He keeps introducing us as his mom and dad, and we keep telling him we are his grandparents. We keep showing him pictures and say, that's his mama."
Ugh, this is just, at the beginning of this episode, you asked me how angry I was prepared to be today. And I think I'm just feeling really sad about this. Like, for Phyllis and for Michelle and her baby boy. Mm-hmm. Like, she has been put in the most helpless situation a mom can be put in. And not only that, but, like, them trying to say things about her daughter when her daughter's no longer here.
Yeah.
It's just, I understand being mad. A lot of it is really anger-inducing, too. But I just, this is probably one of the saddest cases we've talked about, just in how it's being handled.
Yeah. You know, back in the day when this interview happened, Phyllis said that she was still hoping the case would develop against the men. She said, "Someday, somebody is going to slip up and say something. You want to keep her face in the public so people don't forget that she was here." Ultimately, though, Phyllis's goal has always been to bring her daughter home, and that her deepest grief stems from not knowing where Michelle's body is. Phyllis says, "I would have some place to go if I wanted to talk to her, a place to take her a flower on her birthday. I would know where she was."
We are now going to listen to Amy's poem, Field Lament, read by Christine Solomon. Award-winning actress Christine Solomon's work has been exhibited, showcased, and displayed to millions of viewers in Egypt, Canada, and around the world on major television networks and movie studios such as HBO Canada, The Movie Network, Rotana Group, Ubisoft, as well as in print, online, and other advertising media. The theater-trained actor appreciates the opportunity to work for positive causes. She is joined as the lead host for GMC and renowned actor Josh Duhamel's campaign, Building for America's Bravest, and has raised over $17 million. The campaign reached an impressive 110 million viewers. She is also the spokesperson for the Acne and Rosacea Society of Canada's Rosacea Awareness Campaign. On the other side of the camera, Christine has served on the 25th Annual Screen Actors Guild Awards Television Nominating Committee and has been an official juror at various prestigious film festivals around the country.
Field Lament. Michelle Doherty, 17, missing since October 5th, 1985, from Alta Loma, Texas. Out in the Texas fields, the pollen comments across all that blue until it feels like the very beginnings of the universe. Fill the sun-bleached sky, and here, in this rot and rust, the wind pulls the earth back, dirt caking her hands, her fingernails made into dark moons, because this soil has lodged in her lungs, her breath now, landfill night, stones lodged deep in her chest. You can't live in a place like this. Out here, the men have learned the ways women break. This an easy kind of violence. Sometimes at night, I think of the women we lost. How their voices would sound like an explosion if they all spoke at once. Instead, we gather at a field's edge, watch the clouds turn across the surface of the earth. Our ears tuned to the whisper of wind through the grass, as though it can bring us salvation.
For more information about our show or to check out other shows on the network, please visit evergreenpodcast.com. Bye, Vanessa.
Bye, Amy.